realize. And thanks to everybody who has asked for back up. Ben Birch is in the process. Building Dr. Bill's archive at whiterosesociety.org. Until such time as that happens, however, I am putting, and thanks to everybody who has written to ask for an invitation to the Horn Drop Box. I think I've answered all of them, but if I haven't, let me know. It's possible over the course of a day, my email box, it's a bigger mess than the desk here. But I try to answer them all. I try to get out all the invitations that anybody requests. So bobkincaid@gmail.com if you aren't in on the Horn Drop Box and you would like to be. Okay? So, now going back to before I threw the fifth switch, and maybe that's the problem. It's the fifth problem. Thank you. Thank you very much, Isaac. Bob Kincaid, stop doing drugs, Bob. I don't think it's the stopping part. I think I may be under-medicated, Isaac. But at any rate, no. I do want to go back to what Jim said before I hit the fifth switch, because it was trenchant. If only this man could address the combined houses of Congress. Marvelous presentations, inform and content, my compliments and respect. Thank you, Jim. This is mighty special, what Dr. Bill is doing. And eventually this is going to, I had an off-air conversation with Kevin in Colorado Springs, who said to me, I think one of the reasons that that people have not yet been calling Dr. Bill is because none of us want to break in on what he's doing, because it's so unusually informative and so brilliant. And I kind of get that. But this is going to become, you know, once there's a body of work to discuss there, once he's gotten into it a little bit further, there will be greater discussion of the topics at hand. In fact, in the course of laying out the future of this program, it started out as 2 hours a day, 3 days a week. It may expand down the road. It may expand into 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Dr. Bill and I were talking about that just earlier today. It depends on demand. So, just bear that in mind, and we're going to get a little better about communication between Dr. Bill's location and my location so that he can better know when people are, in fact, on the line. Now, to go back again to something that I put out there before I threw the fifth switch, and that is this. First of all, our good friend Robert in Australia wrote, he said, and this is based on an email exchange. I sleep with one eye open and both ears, and so I had gotten, for some reason the inner tube slowed down last week, and I got a note from Robert, and it beeped in the middle of the night, and I saw when it, well, because it had been sent like 5 hours before. That's slow for the internet. No, that's glacial for the internet. They said, I hope this doesn't beep in the night and wake anyone. It didn't, Robert. Time for my regular March 20th Down Under Challenge. Better make it $150 again, as you'll be away for a few days. Thank you. Thank you, Robert. So that's out there. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So too is the snail mail address, which is as follows. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB, personal mailbox, PMB 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV, 25801. And so that challenge stands, $150 to be matched by Robert for the first 150 that comes in. and that will help us get a little bit ahead in fundraising with this trip to D.C. in the offing. But again, a reminder, I plan to be on air practically every regular show night that I'm there, and I trust that the technology will be a little more cooperative after the some of the tweaking that's gone on. Okay, so enough of that. So it is the middle of the week. It is hump day. It is downhill to Friday from here. But brethren and sistren, it is so much more than that. Hallelujah, glory, ha! It's prayer meeting Wednesday on the horn. And so with the challenge from Brother Robert, already in the collection plate, we will send the plates around the congregation. And you can press that little PayPal button in the bottom of the plate, or you can mail it in, as the saying goes, brethren and sisters. Now, as the plates begin to circulate, we will call forward our minister of music to bring us our opening hymn of inspiration and edification. Glory. Brother Minister of Music, if you would, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen.
Amen.
Let me hear you say, Praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet when it comes around.
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah. Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Present for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, he's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. It's not the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of Buddha, solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity. Whoever said religion should be free?
Oh, what's that roasting on the rillera and a brawler, brawler, sue it? I love you. This is the Cathedral of Common Sense. Hallelujah, glory. And I am Archpope Uber Rabbi Ultimate Imam Animated Animist Sanctified Spiritualist, Agonizing Agnostic, Bob Kincaid. And I encourage you, brethren and sistren, I exhort you, hallelujah, to come on down that blood-red aisle and fall upon your knees at the altar. Glory, eternal glory. And lay your hands upon the subwoofer and feel the healing rays of common sense and reason a-flowing through you like a mighty river, hallelujah, glory, ha! From the server on high. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed, brethren and sistren. It is prayer meeting Wednesday on the horn. And, oh, we got a passel. We got a passel to deal with. We're all done with the new pope. Pope Frank out there. Doing it my way, glory. So So it's time to get back over and work the Protestant side of the street. Yes, brethren and sisters, I heard from Deacon Peter Godbold earlier today. He sent me the story of the Right Reverend John Hagee. You'll remember John Hagee. He's the one who told hungry people in America, in the name of Jesus, mind you, to starve. That's how he said it, too. Starve! Well, over there to the John Hagee Ministries, they got more dollars than they got cents. And they throw it around buying things like bandwidth and putting up, throwing massive amounts of money into internet broadcast operations. And he's got a little something-something he calls the Hagee Hotline. We don't know if it comes with gravy or not. I tend to think of it as the Hagee Hot Mess. People, and I use the term loosely, write to Pastor Hagee with requests for advice and clarification on their spiritual lives. Now, this man no more has a soul than I can't think of anything quite as soulless as John Hagee. This man is an animated lump of dough. Now, John Hagee, he hates the Homer sectionals. And he wanted to put out a warning for us. Because he had a question, a very important question put to him. And bless their hearts, the folks over to Right Wing Watch, they captured it. I hope somebody's laying the healing hands of faith on those interns over to Right Wing Watch that have to actually watch this stuff real time and clip it out and make little notes about, let's see, 3 minutes, show open, OO.OO. Show open, OO.OO.01, Pastor Hagee, certifiably nuts! 03.27.15, Pastor Hagee takes questions. Mark! And here it is.
Does eventually completely legalize homosexuality.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I didn't have everything potted up just right. Well, someday I'll have me a producer. Let's get the full tenor of this important theological question for Merca.
If the government does eventually completely legalize homosexual marriage, would God hold us accountable as Christians? Also, does it make a difference that we are only changing our worldly laws and not his laws?
In other words, can we negotiate with the Creator on high who is obviously as homophobic as Pastor Hagee is? Right? We got the question? Yeah, we got the question. Oh, dear. Now the answer.
First of all, let me say that Sodom and Gomorrah is God's pilot study for his response to the homosexual society.
Okay, we're going to have to stop for a minute. Yeah, I knew I wouldn't get through it. Okay, first of all, we have to note that Sodom and Gomorrah is imaginary! Now, there are places in the Bible that are mentioned that were real. Egypt was real. Whether there was ever slavery or bondage or Exodus is certainly not supported by the archaeological record. But slavery is real. That's in the Bible. In fact, the Bible approves of slavery. Slaves behave before your masters, or some such nonsense, I think St. Paul prattles on around about in the middle of one of his hallucinations. I got a feeling after working with all of those nasty-ass natural chemicals, he was a tent maker, you know. Everything. It wasn't just Jesus talking to him. I mean, it was frogs and snakes and stones by the road. Yo, Paul, is this a talking rock? You're damn right. Quit huffing the tent making fumes. But slavery is a reality. It's noted in the Bible. Egypt is in the Bible. Egypt really existed. Syria, Babylon, and Gomorrah? Not so much. So, understanding that Pastor Hagee is about to deliver his opinion on a question asked by a really stupid person in the first place, and he's going to base the entirety of his answer upon the bigotries that he draws out by virtue of his own homophobia, draws out from the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Because, see, your average fundamentalist thinks that Sodom and Gomorrah done got destroyed by God because God hates the homos, and the homos was in the Sodom and Gomorrah, and they was wanting to do their homo stuff on them angels what God sent down to warn Lot. You know, the things God warns about are sometimes curious. Mysterious are the ways, you know. God sent angels to tell, who, by the way, as I've mentioned on the History Channel, history, right? History, ancient aliens. there was a double katana wielding ninja angel in Sodom and Gomorrah, just saying. The bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky sends down a pair of angels, one of whom was presumably a double katana-wielding ninja who looked a little bit like the young George Takei from the episode where he ripped his shirt off and did karate in the middle of the corridors of the Enterprise. That's the one where Spock had the beard, too. Star Trek reference. Hey, it's as viable as a biblical reference, please. So God, and he's warning Lot about how bad Sodom and Gomorrah done become. Now, the interpretation to be had of that by the people whose book this book of myths and fables this actually is that they were being warned because they had become self-absorbed and kind of nasty and not very nice to strangers. But in the weird fundamentalist kind of Fred Phelpsy world that Pastor Hagee lives in. No, it was all that again going on that got Sodom and Gomorrah in the hot soup. And that got passed down by an incredibly benighted, ignorant, stupid, superstitious church over the course of 2,000 years, the Christians. Who, for some reason or another, decided they hated the homosexuals. Even though a whole bunch of them was. Pastor Hagee wants to cite Sodom and Gomorrah, which is a fable in the Old Testament. Book of Genesis? As support for his weird, twisted, semi-hallucinogenic, shoot him in the neck with a thorazine dart and catch him with a butterfly net kind of interpretation. Really, this guy should be in a one of those lovely dinner jackets with the sleeves that tie in the front after they've been around the back. Or tie in the back after they've been around the front. I've never really been in a straight jacket. But anyway, yeah, he should be in one of those writing on the walls of his little padded cell with a purple crayon between his toes. But he's going to base all this on Sodom and Gomorrah. And as I've told you before, once upon a time, I had a cup of coffee in the anthropology department. Archaeology was the first big word I ever learned as a child. It really, really was. And from the first moment that I gazed into one of my grandmother's archaeology books, I was smitten, and I remain smitten. I just over the weekend, I read the story about the fact that in England, they have dug up what appears to be an emergency cemetery that dates back to the bubonic plague. You know, bring out your dead. Bring out your dead. Here's one. Nonsense. See you Thursday. I'm not dead. You know, that. Years later, after that was, I spent some time on an archaeological dig, and it remains three of the most amazing months that have ever happened in my life. I mean, it's not up there with the birth of my children or anything, but it's three truly amazing months. And being young and stupid and not barely trusted with my own trowel, I was taught techniques in what the people thought was pretty likely a sterile pit. A sterile pit is where you put the young archaeologist to make sure that he can't fuck up the dig. Sorry. And so, in the blazing heat of West Tennessee, with a ball cap on that read Bow Hunters of Alabama, and a bandana under that cap that was periodically soaked in water and draped down across my incredibly pink neck to keep it from turning blood red in that southwest Tennessee sun, I learned troweling techniques and sketching techniques and screening techniques and whisk brooming and how to take a pit down a couple of centimeters at a time and how to properly put an edge on my trowel. And it was magnificent. There were deer flies there. You know, we were talking about the bone-breaking, Sandra and I were talking about the bone-breaking mosquitoes that are in Florida. Oh, summer's going to be lovely at the Magic Kingdom. The deer flies there, they had little racing stripes on their wings. And every now and then you'd get one. Like, oh, that's the last meal. But I'll never forget that moment when, with my trowel, and there's an unmistakable ring. Ding. What the? In my sterile pit. And for all it mattered to me, I suddenly had a fleeting understanding in that dink of what went through Howard Carter's mind and Heinrich Schliemann's and Arthur Evans's and, you know, the heroic archaeologist of the late 19th and early 20th century who screwed up more digs than we can count. But that turned out to be a little tiny piece of pottery, no bigger than a quarter. Just a piece of broken pottery. After it got brushed off and after I'd photographed it and drawn it, and you could see these little decorative incised lines that had been baked into the clay. And I held it. And even though it was a work of imagination, in that little tiny quarter-sized piece of broken pottery, an entire world filled in around it. Of people who had been gone, or at least a culture that had been gone, not the people, they certainly have ancestors, or progeny. They're the ancestors of somebody. There we go. You'll get there, Bob. But a whole world filled in for me. And suddenly it wasn't a barren mound site, but it became the city that it had been. And it really was a city. Jesus, God, there were estimated to be in excess of 1,000 mounds of various sizes on that site. Some of them no more than 6 inches off the ground, just dirt platforms that you put up before you build your hut. But on the other hand, there were two of the largest mounds outside of Cahokia, Illinois. Mound my ass, they were pyramids. Second tallest earthen pyramid in the United States, after Monk's Mound in Cahokia. If you ever get near Cahokia, that's worth your time. But it really was a city. And there was data. And provenance. And artifacts. And dead folks. Then there's Sodom and Gomorrah. And so all of that is by way of background to explain that I went when I saw that Pastor John Hagee starve was going to go wandering off around Sodom and Gomorrah, a little light went on in my head, and I just wanted to check what I could using the interweb tubes. You know, it's not a big truck. And I couldn't find any evidence for a historical Sodom and Gomorrah. So I checked in with Dr. John. I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to be running off into the land of the wrong, because I'm pretty sure that nobody's ever identified Sodom and Gomorrah. Akkad? Sumer? Yes. Jericho? Yes. Ashkelon? Yes. No Sodom. No Gomorrah. So I checked in with Dr. John just to see, to get his expert opinion. And he said, first of all, let's make a few assumptions about when exactly we're talking about in the past. Golly Moses, just like Jim said that he'd like for Dr. Bill to be able to address both houses of Congress, I'd just love for Pastor John Starve Hagee to hear Dr. John, or to hear Dr. John's words. Maybe it'd make him a little less hateful. Nah, not really. He's a freak. Hagee. But Dr. John says, let's make a few assumptions about when exactly we're talking about in the past. Let's assume that the Sodom and Gomorrah period, if you will, was somewhere around 2200 before the Common Era. That's BCE. Some folks still hang on to BC. BCE is much more civilized. It's always risky to try to locate oral histories in a specific time frame. Same thing applies to, for instance, the Iliad and the Odyssey. Remember me talking about the early heroes of archaeology who screwed up more sites than we can count? Yeah, Heinrich Schliemann. Went running right out of the dig in Asia Minor. I found the death mask of Priam! Because he too got enamored of archaeology as a child, but he had the wherewithal to go out. And he's got, he had his wife decked out in an exquisite piece of neckwear. And I don't mean a necktie, I mean, you know, like fancy ass necklace. And that was Helen's, was it? He said. Just crazy crap. Shoehorning. Oh, well, what did they say in the Downing Street memo about the Iraq War? They were going to fit the intelligence to the situation or something like that? Yeah, well, biblical archaeology is like that. So that's what Dr. John's talking about when he says it's always risky to try to locate oral histories in a specific time frame. But from a quick search, Dr. John says, this seems to be the general consensus about the time period of Sodom and Gomorrah, i.e. 2200 BCE, i.e. 4200 years ago. So, asks Dr. John, what was happening in the region around 2200 BCE? Well, this is, he says, the tail end of the Akkadian period in Mesopotamia, when the center of gravity was shifting from Akkad to Ur. A period of contraction, then expansion. Can we have one of those little biblical moments here? Lot, who gets warned in Sodom, is the nephew of Abraham, who changed his name from Abram because he was on the run, probably from the law. A lot of name changing in the Bible. He's Abraham's nephew. That means he's almost absolutely younger than Abraham, right? Anybody? Sunday school class? I know there's more than, I know I'm not the only recovering religion victim out here. Where did Abraham, who was then known as Abram, where did he come from? Genesis says Abram went on his wanderings after having been given a hallucination by the bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky. Out of Ur of the Chaldees. Ur of the Chaldees. But what did Dr. John just tell us here? This is the tail end of the Akkadian period in Mesopotamia when the center of gravity was shifting from Akkad to Ur. I think we have a conflict. A period of contraction, then expansion out of southern Mesopotamia when Ur was making links to Harappa in the east. We talked about Harappa a couple of nights ago. The whole focus in Mesopotamia, which was where everything was happening in the Near East, Mesopotamia being sort of Greeky for middle of the rivers, land between the rivers, meso, middle. Mesopotamia, yeah, land between the rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. The whole focus in Mesopotamia, which was where everything was happening in the Near East, was eastward toward India, not westward toward the Dead Sea area. Presumably, that's because there wasn't a whole lot going on in what's now Israel-Palestine at this time. We may argue that that was the last time that region was ever peaceful. Nothing there worth trading with or protecting against. In Egypt, we're at the end of the Old Kingdom. Also a period of contraction and upheaval. Refugees from, yes, Palestine, were imported into Egypt as laborers, and they eventually took over and deposed the pharaohs for centuries until the New Kingdom restoration and expansion. But that was nearly a millennium later, you know, around 1200 BCE. Somewhere in there, around 1400, comes the collapse of the Minoan civilization, which just fascinates me. Alongside in, also along in there, well, never mind. I'm getting too far afield as it is. Dr. John continues, so we have two large and powerful, though inward-focused, and that's important, civilizations, bookending what's now the Dead Sea area in the time when Sodom and Gomorrah were supposedly thriving. I mean, Sodom and Gomorrah, twin cities, you know, long before Minneapolis and St. Paul. You can't say, you know, wasn't it Sodom and Gomorrah. And Egypt was accepting refugees from the region where the city supposedly existed. Why would they do that if there was a powerful, organized proto-civilization in the homeland? Some question. Not to say there were no people around the Dead Sea. Jericho was certainly real. Its ruins were first excavated back in the 1950s. Jericho was a succession of settlements going back to the earliest permanent settlements in the Near East, about 8,000 years before the Sodom and Gomorrah period. That's 10,200 years. Around 2200 BCE, Jericho was undergoing one of its routine contractions. Cultures expand, cultures contract. It was probably the biggest settlement in the Dead Sea area around this time. Two city blocks in size, home to 2,000 people at the outside. That's the biggest city in the area. For reference, Ur was the largest city in the world at this time, home to perhaps 60,000 people. You know, a middling-sized college football stadium. The point is, the Dead Sea area was a backwater in this period. If there were two large, even Jericho-sized cities in the southern Dead Sea, we'd know about it. We'd find large and obvious mounds covered with pottery. We'd find trails of trade goods and outlying villages and evidence of roads visible in aerial photography. Hell, we'd probably find written accounts, as both Babylon and Egypt were writing by this time, and they were writing everything down. They were meticulous record keepers. And it's fascinating, the stuff the Egyptians wrote about. In Babylon, cuneiform inscriptions, written in Akkadian, were mostly used to keep records of trade goods to outlying cities and other civilizations. Bills of lading, if you will. And so if they were shipping anything, you'd have a waybill. Dr. John notes those Mesopotamians were great record keepers, but they never saw fit to mention big cities around the Dead Sea. You know, caravan of 112 camels left today, headed for Sodom and Gomorrah with loads of the frankincense and myrrh and yaws and goiters. On a final note, Dr. John says, the problem with trying to use archaeology to prove the Bible is that archaeology is great about demonstrating that certain things and people existed and interacted in various ways, but it's not so great at explaining why. That's what oral history, folklore, mythology, and so on excel at. Sodom and Gomorrah may be bad history and bad archaeology, but they're great stories. Very useful for teaching lessons around the dinner table and in a place of worship. I'm very happy, says Dr. John, to keep those two domains separate. Unfortunately, if I may editorialize on what Dr. John closed with, that is an absolute knuckle-busting effort that has to be made by the people in the real science community and the real social sciences community to keep them separate. Because remember, your average fundy likes to think about back when Adam and Eve rode to the tabernacle on their dinosaurs. So, in other words, we've got an element of proof right off the bat, 25 seconds into a minute and 15 second clip, that Pastor John Hagee is, unsurprisingly, a filthy liar, who is going to bootstrap his hatred and his bigotry onto a tale first put in writing maybe 2,500 years ago about something, about a culture that, if it existed at all, existed another 1,700 years before. That's like one of us sitting down right now and trying to write out an accurate history of life in the year 300. Lucky for us, we had the Romans to do it firsthand. And the Greeks. But if you really had to, how much could you write down about life in 4th century empire? How much could you write down? Okay, never mind. Never mind the stuff everybody knows about Constantinople, Rome. What if you had to sit down right now and write down everything you know about the little itsy bitsy teensy weensy speck on the map that would eventually become Paris? Or London. Or, you get the idea. 300 CE, what? For 100 or 200 years after, by then maybe, there'd been a little town simply called Colonia on the banks of the Rhine that we now know as Köln or Cologne. Yeah. What could you sit down and write accurately about the origins, the first days of Cologne in Germany? Not bloody much. So instead,
You make some stuff up. And since you're making stuff up anyway, you might as well make it resonate with some level of morality, ethics, religious terror, whatever it is you need the youngins to figure out. Maybe one day there at the dinner table that Dr. John was talking about, maybe your daughter has said, you know Stephanie, our next door neighbor? Yeah, baby. Well, we were out working our weaving today, and she asked if she could borrow a ball of yarn, and I told her to get her own. And so perhaps mother would then say, well, Tiffany, did I ever tell you the story about Sodom and Gomorrah? Because, you know, God wiped them out down to the last stone because they were a bunch of inhospitable asses, and they weren't neighborly. Now, you don't want God to smite us, do you? If she asks you for a ball of yarn, trust her with a ball of yarn, and make sure, and I'm sure she'll give one back to you. Yes, Mother. See how it works? Cautionary tales. But anyway, we've probably forgotten the whole reason for all of this digression by now. Back to Pastor John.
If the government does eventually completely legalize homosexual marriage, would God hold us accountable as Christians? Also, does it make a difference that we are only changing our worldly laws and not His laws?
Honest to God, I'm convinced people are out. You know how smart alecks call C-SPAN because they know that there's no 7-second delay, and they say booger on the air? I think this is that. I think smart aleck atheists are writing these questions, don't you? Would God hold us accountable as Christians? Well, Pastor John Starve Hagee comes, I think, out of the Baptist tradition, and they are very, very squarely in the once saved, always saved camp. So the quick answer is no. No, God's not going to hold us accountable for laws that are that are passed in Washington or interpreted by the Supreme Court. No. We don't. No, he doesn't. No, we're Christians. We live by grace. And they're right. You understand? I've had that speech too many times. But never mind.
First of all, let me say that Sodom and Gomorrah is God's pilot study for His response.
God's pilot fantasy.
To the homosexual society. The fact is that not everyone in Sodom and Gomorrah was homosexual. When Abraham was bargaining with God for 50 righteous, 40 righteous, 30 righteous, 20 righteous, and finally it leveled off for 10. He said, will you save Sodom and Gomorrah for 10 righteous? He was saying that there...
All right, have I screwed up somewhere? Was it Abraham in Sodom and Gomorrah? Or was it Lot? Because it's Lot's wife that gets turned into the pillar of salt, right? I don't have time to go rooting around through the fables, but is old Starve Hagee, who could use a little slim fast himself, is he playing fast and loose, you know, with the Holy Scripture, the literal and perfect word of the Almighty God? Is he?
That this would be 10 people who opposed homosexuality. They were not found.
Man, that's some gloss. He's a professional glosser. 10 righteous people becomes 10 people who oppose homosexuality. Never mind the fact that there is not a translation of the scripture out there. Scripture just means writing. There's not a translation of the writing out there that says homosexuals. He's just making crap up. And it is crap.
So here's the measuring rod. It's not if...
He said rod.
The government...
He's talking about homosexuals, and he said rod. Oh, Dr. Freud. Yeah, yeah, Bob, slip showing, I know. Rod.
He was saying that there would be, that this would be 10 people who opposed homosexuality. They were not found. So here's the measuring rod. It's not if the government...
Oh, he even stumbled Freudianly over Rod. Rod.
Proves it. It's if the people...
He's a Freudian Max Headroom. Rod.
Found. So here's the measuring rod. It's not if the government approves it. It's if the people accept it. And if the righteous accept.
Okay, you got that? It's not if the government approves it. It's if the people accept it. You understand that one little tiny statement there? He is absolutely denying the idea of popular government. See, this is what the right-wing fundamentalist religion industry has been so successful at doing. And the Republican Party in general, of whom the fundies are their shock troops. Absolutely negating the idea of self-rule, self-government. Until you've got an entire region of the country and the bigger part of an entire demographic who draw a line of distinction between the government and themselves.
Rod, it's not if the government approves it. It's if the people accept it. And if the righteous accept it, judgment will come.
Come. Now, there's a dozen different ways to say that. God's judgment will be delivered. People will be judged. The righteous will be judged. Nope. Judgment will come. You know, via that rod. Phew. Yeah, so thanks to our buddies at Right Wing Watch. God, I love them. See, these stories at first blush are funny. God's pilot study, really? Well, there's the god of irony at work. I just had a bit of a snicker over the word rod. And I get an email from Isaac. Porn legend Harry Reams, dead at 65. Today is a sad day. Now, this looks, to a normal person with a functioning brain, living in the real and natural world, Pastor Hagee is somebody, oh, what a freak. Because that's the easy out. But the serious part of this is that there is no greater threat to the government of this country, you know, the government of we, the people. There is no greater threat than the likes of Pastor Hagee, because he cannot be held to account in any way, shape, form, or fashion. He is not subject to the unseen, all-powerful hand of the free market. He is not subject to regulation because he has the skirts of the First Amendment to hide behind, or maybe in. And from behind that, from behind that blind, he can engage in subornation of sedition and treason with impunity. And that means something. This is hate speech. That line about if the people accept it, that's Fundy dog whistling. That's Pester Hagee telling his fundamentalist, mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, snake-handling, floor-rolling, strychnine-swigging, tongue-speaking followers that it's okay to go and slaughter a few gay people if the Supreme Court actually strikes down the Defense of Marriage Act, which I do not accept, which I do not expect to happen. The DOMA being struck down. Sure, we have our fun at these goobers' expense, but we only do so with the understanding that we know way down deep how absolutely dangerous these monsters are. And they are dangerous. Because they intend, it is their fondest hope. Imagine that. A ruling by the Supreme Court that can be challenged by violence on the part of the followers of the Prince of Peace. That is what this man is talking about. And if that does not in turn give you pause for reflection, that is followed by a determination not to see this government done in by the likes of John Hagee. If we don't understand the danger that these freaks pose, well, then eventually, they're going to get the theocracy for which they so decidedly yearn. To the email bag, Ron and Raleigh picked it up right away. Hey, wait a minute, Bob. Wasn't the sin of Sodom inhospitality? Well, yeah, that's what their holy book says, but they never cite that part, Ron. Tim from L.A. with an observation, he says, just a friendly reminder why God did destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, assuming they existed, from Ezekiel 16, 49 and 50. Now this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy. They were haughty and did detestable things before me. Therefore I did away with them, as you have seen. But yeah, Tim caught it. You hear all the double entendre, Bob? Rod, come? My gosh, there are more references to the male private parts from Christianity than the LGBTQ community. I guess Hagee's coming out of the closet. Granny T from Tennessee writing in, hey, Bob, nice to hear you speak of your adventures here in West Tennessee. My son, close to 40 now, worked the digs during the summers when he was in college. It's a wonderful, spiritual, in fact, place. Church night's my favorite, Brother Bob. Certainly does justice to history and religion in all its glory, gory glory, whatever you call it, well, you're the Rev and I am your little heathen. Granny T says, sent a pittance to your ministry via snail mail in honor of the Ides of March. Hope you've received it. Best this heathen can do right just now. Good thoughts to the Rev and the Horn family, Granny T in Tennessee. Thank you, Granny T. Thank you very much. I will double check with Boss Man Wayne. He attends to the mailbox. Sandra asking by Twitter, do you have that starve bit from Pastor Hagee to entertain us? I used to. I don't know what happened to that. I need to find that again someday. Starve! I can do it almost as good. And if you want to sit on your blessed assurance, see how he said ass in church and didn't get you right. Yeah, the preachers are good at that kind of sit on your blessed assurance. Well, you can just starve. Then this from Philip. Philip says, when I lived in the Lone Star State, it didn't take me too long to figure out that Pastor Hagee and his lovely family served those who preferred to buy their righteousness by the pound. Frankly, Bob, I'd never before seen human beings who were entirely... Frankly, Bob, I'd never before seen human beings who were entirely square. And I don't think Philip means in like the hippie, you know, oh, you're such a square dude. No. The man packs them in San Antonio, and I always wondered if that was attributable to the great air conditioning in his facilities. As for me, I was a Benny Hinn and Robert Tilton man. Those fighting words. If I'm going to support religious frauds, I want them to be overt, not to mention that, unlike Pastor Hagee, they didn't speak like their mouths were set to do in a poor man's imitation of George W. Just saying. Entirely square. Toaster. And this in from Kate. Happy Norwoos. The Persian New Year that is celebrated around the globe, the beginning of spring, a new year. That's when civilized people should celebrate the new year. When the year is new. The best news on the queer front, says Kate, the house across the street from the Phelps compound has been purchased by an out-of-stater who was tired of the antics of that church. He has tastefully painted the house the colors of the pride flag. I saw that. This pukey pastor story isn't funny ever, not even on the face of it. He and his ilk are dangerous because so many folks take him seriously and believe the bullshit. Walmart aisles are full of them. Yet don't ever, well, don't walk through a Walmart. Don't ever walk through the book aisle of a Walmart. Touched by an angel, licked by an angel, kissed by an angel, private parts tickled by the feather of an angel, left behind by an angel. Jesus. And Kate also noting with regard to Dr. Bill, she says, another great lecture. I agree with Kevin. I don't want to call in to interrupt Dr. Bill. I can hardly contain myself and my fingers to add to the discussion. The most recent light to go on was to understand that I have been blessed with some extraordinary mentors and teachers who evidently didn't understand nor subscribe to Jefferson's idea of education. I was trained to be contentious, questioning, disruptive, and argumentative. All of this because most of my teachers demanded I reach well beyond what I perceive to be my potential. I am beginning to understand why most of those who are educated in the past four decades don't think the way I do. I need to take notes in order that I can share with Dr. Bill some of my ideas. And, Peter Dolan, hugs to you for sending in the Pastor Hagee story. Signed, Kate, on the Front Range. So I think that pretty well catches us up. And with that in mind, we'll take a little break. A couple of folks on hold for the beginning of this evening's conversation. This is one of the few cathedrals where there's conversation. Most of it's just hear and behave. Thanks very much to Sal getting us started this evening answering Robert's Down Under Challenge. It is much appreciated, Sal. Thank you. So let's take a little break. 304-658-3333 is the number. Here endeth the lesson. Email comes in to Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. If you want to get on the, if you want to get on the conversation via Skype, well, the contact, handle here is Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. Bob Kincaid Horn. Okie doke. Can we do that? Light them up. This is the horn.
I lit up the airwaves. Here is my request. You don't have to play it, but I hope you'll do your best. I've been listening to your show on the radio, and you seem like a friend to me.
Of your choice, I don't mind. I'd be happy just to hear your voice saying this is for the girl who didn't sign her name. Guess she needs a dedication just the same. Late at night, I'm still listening. Don't waste my time chasing sleep. People say I look weary, but that's just the company I keep.
Nighttime race. Ooh, I don't need to see your face.
You're sounding good.
Sounding good.
Sounding good to me.
I lit up the airwaves. Here is my request. You don't have to play it, but I hope you'll do your best. I've been listening to your show on the radio, and you seem like a friend to me. Time race. Ooh, I don't need to see your face.
You're sounding good.
Sounding good.
Sounding good. Oh, it sounds so good to me.
My airways, here is my request. You don't have to play it, but I hope you'll do your best. Have your show on the radio. And you seem like a friend to me.
Oh, I've been listening to your show on the radio.
And you seem like a friend to me.
Your second hour in the liberal sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
I don't know why that song popped into my tired old DJ head when I heard God's Pilot Project. No, for pity's sake. This is Prayer Meeting Wednesday on the Horn. And, if you went out and found it, Isaac, thank you. Yeah, here we go. We'll go to the phones, but thank you, Isaac, for finding the starve! the clip. I know you're tired of hearing me say it, so I won't say it again. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Jeremy.
Hey, Jeremy, what's happening?
Hopefully we'll get hung up again. We're here Monday night.
Yeah, with any luck.
I think that was me, though, in all honesty. I was going to say thank you, first of all, for saying about the Earth and Moon BS. It was a pyramid. They're everywhere. Our history is not what we've been told. I almost guarantee that. A lot of things are taught that didn't necessarily happen the way they happened. I mean, it's about 50 years ago, you probably would have been laughed at if you said that Columbus wasn't the first person to find America. In fact, he probably wasn't the fifth.
Well, did you know, Jeremy, that when the data regarding the Norse settlement of what they called Vinland was first put out, that there were near riots in the Italian community?
Yeah, I heard that. There's good evidence they came as far north as Rhode Island. Not just Vikings, but other cultures. So the fact that we say Christopher Columbus was the first one to discover America, BS all the way around.
Well, there's so much BS surrounding Christopher, because among other, part of the pablum that's in the world thought the world was flat, except Christopher Columbus, who done thought it was round, you know, like a cantaloupe. But the craziness proceeds from there. There was a general consensus at the time that the world was round. But the problem was, largely because of the suppression of knowledge by Holy Mother Church, people didn't know how big the world was. Now, the size of the globe had been pretty accurately estimated during the time of the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt. I forget which scientist did it. But he did it by measuring shadow, using sticks to measure shadows at high noon in Alexandria and Heliopolis or something like that. It was known data, but it was lost. And
I was going to say sticks. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Bob.
But the thing is, nobody knew how big it was. So actually, instead of being more right than wrong, Columbus was more wrong than right, because he sold a bunch of bourgeois to the king and queen of Spain, telling them, no, really, it's just off the coast. It's a couple of days' sail. And, you know, we'll be in Cathay. Oops.
I was going to say sticks and shadows and measuring the sun shadow. That's how the Vikings circumnavigated the globe, too. They had primitive, almost like floating compasses, but that's widely speculated how they did it. So that doesn't surprise me at all. They did it long before he even thought of doing it. The other thing I wanted to call in about was that I tried to tell you Monday, all those Republicans and teabaggers that came out and said we voted for the Violence Against Women Act, they did. They voted for the act that cut out anyone but women, because they called everyone else a special interest group.
Well, and cut out a bunch of women themselves because they voted for the one that did not include the ability of tribal peoples to prosecute rapes on tribal land. So, you know, everybody but, right. But, you know, some of the all the women except some of the absolutely most endangered ones.
Right. And then I came across a story, and you may have seen that I linked it to your Facebook wall today, of an Arizona representative who wants to make it a class 4 misdemeanor for a transgender person to use a bathroom other than their original sex.
Yeah, I saw that.
It is sickening.
Well, and what was even more sickening out of that story, Jeremy, was that it wasn't just that the law was introduced. It included some, you know, demeaning, some shaming. The individual who introduced it was a right-wing creep by the name of John Kavanaugh, who I assume has issues. He said, the city of Phoenix has crafted a bill that allows people to define their sex by what they think in their head If you're a male, you don't go into a female shower or locker room or vice versa. It also raises the specter. Note that specter. Really? The specter? Of people who want to go into those opposite sex facilities not because they're transgender, but because they're weird.
People fear what they don't understand. Stories like this personally touch me. Won't go any deeper than that, but they personally touch me. So it irritates me.
Well, it should irritate anybody with a freaking conscience.
Isn't that too? But I mean, certain groups it will irritate even more. But yes, like I said, people fear what they don't understand. It's the biggest problem we have, and unfortunately, it's also hatred. Hatred comes from fear. And you're never going to be able to eradicate fear and hate. It's always going to be there. All you have to do is scratch the surface, and you'll find it somewhere.
And, of course, there's a little birtherism tucking its way into this law as well, Jeremy, because basically this creep says that you have to show your birth certificate to get into the bathroom.
Right, and that's even creepier.
So, not to go delve too far into detail, one, I have tremendous respect for and sympathy for people in the transgendered community because, A, they are some of the most put-upon humans in this sad nation. Two, if they have actually acknowledged what their sexuality is, it has come probably at a terrible, terrible price. And three, they're being themselves. Male to female, right, female to male, matters not to me.
And I can say from personal experience that times are changing. The boundary has been pushed back quite a bit from what it used to be. For the most part, people that are true friends don't care one way or the other. They never will. They don't question it. They see you for who you are.
For sure.
And that's all that matters in the end. At least that has come that far. Although, the Achilles heel of this is that when push comes to shove, sometimes their words don't match their mouth or don't match their intentions. Because it's all fine and dandy if you say, hey, this is who I am, as long as you say who you are at that point. If you become someone else, that's when the fear factor kicks in, and sometimes they take back those statements and go the opposite direction. So it's still there, even though they say they might agree with it.
Absolutely it is. And, you know, it is... There's a level of shallowness attendant upon all of this that is it's not shocking, it's just pathetic. Imagine judging someone. You know, the only quote from Dr. Martin Luther King that the right wing knows is that a man should be judged on the content of his character, not the color of his skin. Right? Because that's the only thing. Well, that's what Dr. King said, right? Never mind what he said about social justice, the war in Vietnam, blah, 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 blah. That's what they know. So they're all on board with not judging a person by the color of their skin, but by the content of a person's character. And yet, here's generally speaking, the right wing of this country that wants to judge someone on the style of their clothing. You know, I think I touched on this last night. Or maybe Monday night, the idea that men in this culture are absolutely pigeonholed into a terribly, terribly narrow self-definition by virtue of outward appearance. And there's stuff that ties into this about male privilege. You know, I think male to female transgendered people, cross-dressers, transsexuals, whatever, are particularly loathed by some quarters of this culture because they are challenging male privilege. They're trying to throw it away. They want no part of it. And a society that is founded upon a privilege like that cannot tolerate that people would say that the emperor is wearing the wrong clothes, but the emperor has no clothes. You know, for Christ's sakes, up until what, the French Revolution? Guess who wore most of the lace?
It was males.
Who wore the high-heeled shoes?
It was males. Look at Shakespeare. All his plays were all acted out by men, men kissing men when they were women.
You're right. For all the freak out that certain quarters of this country are having about the Iran, They invented pants.
They invented a lot of stuff. We don't give them credit.
Windmills. But pants. Yes, pants. Trousers. Jodhpurs. Well, that's a Hindu word, I think. Jesus wore a dress. Caesar wore a dress. Everybody who watched Brad Pitt, well, I think of my wife, who will just watch that Alexander the Great movie over and over and over again. No. Not Brad Pitt. Not Alexander the Great, but that too. No, that was Colin Farrell. Agnes watches Troy over and over and over again. Because she just loves the way Brad Pitt looks in a dress.
I was going to say Egyptian warriors, Roman warriors, they all wore what could be considered a dress today to some extent.
Right, and the barbarians were the ones who didn't, like the Gauls who would weave using things like pitch and resin and so forth. They would weave their hair and their beards into elaborate designs over their body, paint the rest of what didn't have hair on it blue, and run screaming into battle. Those were the barbarians, not the guys in the dresses.
I do also find it funny how quickly baggers and Republicans and staunch conservatives are quick to try to throw in like-minded people like you and me and people in the horn, their faces that Martin Luther King and Abe Lincoln were Republicans. Yes, they were. Not like them, though. Not even close.
No. Not by a long shot.
They like to bring that fact up because they like to try to claim them as their guys to try to hide their own shame.
Look, there is no more resemblance between the modern Republican Party and Abraham Lincoln, except for the fact that Abraham Lincoln did love big business. But still, he had some decent things to say about working people and labor.
Right.
There's no more resemblance between Abraham Lincoln and the modern Republican Party than there is between the hogs and chandeliers. By the way, we had a note in just now from the angry Indian. He said, also people, based on what you said, Jeremy, also people fear what they cannot control. The Republican Party and all homophobes in general really need to stop fucking with the hangers and come on out. They aren't fooling anyone, especially themselves. He says, and hi, Bob and Jeremy.
It's so true. I got to finish with one more kind of comical thing, and you'll probably understand this because you were raised similar to me in terms of the church. I am watching the Bible story on the History Channel just because...
Oh, taking one for the team, are you?
I am. I've had those stories beaten into my head since I was 3. Finally, around 25, I broke free, and I just look at them now. My girlfriend laughs at me because I'm probably more agnostic than I am atheist. But she looks at me and laughs because she won't have any part of it. I said, hey, I was taught these stories my whole life. I find it interesting whether I believe it or not. I said, I just want to feel what they portray it. And to their credit, they have portrayed certain characters other than the devil part. That was a little weird. It's a different light than what white America wants to see these characters as.
Barack Hussein Satan. Oh, Jesus.
That did seem like a bit of a stretch, and I can.
Okay, but am I crazy?
No. He did look. The actor does look a lot like him.
He looks like the guy that Sasha and Malia's children will call Granddad.
Yes, it does.
So I'm watching a little bit of it, and, you know, this is back when I saw the katana-wielding ninja avenging angel in Sodom. And I looked at Agnes and I said, they've got this all wrong. And then I sort of slapped myself and I said, do you realize that that's like me saying, no, Porky Pig is pink. Yeah, they don't have it wrong. It's just a different interpretation of a bunch of made up bullshit in the first place. So, you know, if they want the avenging angel to be a katana wielding ninja, more power to them.
The History Channel departed from real history when they started portraying Pawn Stars and stuff like that in reality television. They're more entertainment now than anything else. History is loosely laced into some of the stuff they do, like I'm trying to think, what was that big blockbuster last year with Kevin Costner? I can't think of the last
one. Oh, the Hatfields and McCoys?
It was loosely based on it.
with a loose definition of the word loose.
It's very loose, but they departed from actual history and went to revisit the history real quickly.
And of course, like I mentioned the other night, I'm still sitting in slack jaw, standing around, in slack jawed amazement, Jeremy, that there is now a show on the Weather Channel about guys who go out in boats to shoot rifles at icebergs.
I didn't hear that one. That's pretty amazing.
Oh, give me the tequila bottle. And apparently they're from Iceland or something. We're roughly in the same area where the Titanic went down. And, oh, look, there's an iceberg. And so, really, they take 30-06s with scopes. With scopes. That's the fun part. That's the part I really loved. Scopes. Because, you know, you really got to take dead aim at a freaking iceberg, Jeremy.
Yeah, it's going to run from you if you're not careful.
And so they try to shoot off hunks of ice and go and grab the ice, which they then put in the boat and take back and sell to somebody who puts it in water, or melts it into water, puts it in bottles, and flies it halfway around the planet so that people can buy iceberg water. And when I started thinking about the carbon footprint of that whole endeavor, I wanted to kick furniture.
Yeah, I would too. And one last thing. That song you played at the intermission, that song fits the whole Malloy horn family, so that can go for everyone.
Well, thanks. I love the lead guitar on that. It's just...
Yeah, it was really good, but definitely the words are striking. That would fit this whole circle of people. They all are very understanding, and there's not a mean... I mean, we can joke and say mean things, but we know it's not that at all. So that's good.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Good. Okay, Bob, have a good night.
You too. Bye now. Calling from Vermont, that's our buddy Jeremy. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Oh, I think we've got a little bit of delay going on here. Because I just heard me talking about the iceberg. Anybody home? Hello? Welcome, wagon. Avon calling. Jehovah's Witness. Landshark. Maybe we'll get lucky next time through. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Jim.
How are you tonight?
I'm feeling kind of chipper.
Before I gathered, I was trying to picture you in one of those Louis the 14th costumes with
the little lace hanky coming out of the cuff and everything.
No, with a big wig and his high heel shoes and stuff like that, you know, le tasse moi.
Yeah. With my high heel shoes and my low neck sweater, get on back home, Loretta. Yeah.
No. The full outfit. That's what you do.
You know, the thing is, that was a bunch of brocades and stuff. That had to be hellish hot in the Parisian summer, didn't it?
Well, I'm certain Versailles didn't smell too good because I think there were only two bathrooms in the whole palace, if I'm not mistaken. Somebody can correct me on that, but they did lack in certain facilities, which I guess necessitated a lot of perfume, a lot of stank.
Well, now we understand why the perfume industry arose en Paris.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And... let me see. Let me just a couple items here, and I will be brief. That's for sure. In pursuit of your reference to working with archaeologists, I can certainly understand that because I did that for a whole summer.
It's transformative, isn't it?
Oh, it's a great way to lose a lot of weight too.
Depending on where you're doing it, yeah. Okay, see.
Because, you know, I worked under a professional archaeologist from the University of South Carolina, Dr. Alan Calmes, and the first thing we did was square off grids with string and stuff like that, and then went in with toothbrushes and very, very small trowels. And we were excavating a powder magazine that the British used during the Revolution. And when they left Camden, that's where it was, in Camden, South Carolina, they dumped all the gunpowder in the moat around the magazine. Originally, it was a colonial magazine. It was made of 144,000 bricks because I found the bills of lading in the Continental Congress papers in Columbia because I was helping him in two works on the site and then in the archive. And, you know, we actually found a British boot. It still had the nails in it or the little hobnails,
mm-hmm.
wooden spikes. And found the gunpowder that they had dumped when they left after the Second Battle of Camden. So it's just amazing what you find. even found the jaw of a horse.
Wow.
So it was an interesting experience for me. And second, Reverend Hagee, for whom I bear little affection, I just never cared for the man, or I've never cared for a lot of what he says, but, you know, hey, he's got a big following, and for him to tell people to starve, well, I think he could definitely hit the Atkins diet for sure, that's for sure.
He's not shoving away from the table ahead of time.
No, I think about the only exercise he gets is when he does shove away from the table. You know, going back to Sodom and Gomorrah, I do believe, and the History Channel has departed in many ways, like the National Geographic Channel. I mean, they really...
Oh, yeah, they're in a dead heat for...
It's just like another reality type thing. But I do believe that they are excavating, as we speak, and have excavated certain two cities, like New Mesra and Bab Adra, in and around the Dead Sea. And they did find that these cities just didn't fall of themselves or go away, that they ended rather violently. And they found evidence of collapsed towers and people who've fallen under the towers and stuff like that. And they believe that perhaps these two cities plus three others could have been the cities of the plain, and it could have been earthquakes, it could have been a number of things, but there was heat involved. And that's a very highly sensitive earthquake area.
Did they find the pillar of salt that...
Bob, if you go to the Dead Sea, you'll find a number of salt structures because it's mainly, you know, surrounded. It's the most saline body of water. I think it's the lowest point of the planet. And so... And that's the reason they can use the, that's where the Dead Sea mud mass came from, because it is good for acne and stuff like that.
Actually, the one that Pat Robertson was hustling was the Sea of Galilee mud mask.
Well, I don't think that's quite correct. I think it's the Dead Sea that has, certain curative properties for skin problems and things like that. I mean, just like...
Right, well, it may very well, but, Pat Robertson was hustling a Sea of Galilee mud mask because that was the deal he worked out with the Israeli government back when he was negotiating building Jesus Land.
Oh, well, I guess Pat got it wrong, didn't he?
Well, I mean, it depends on how many people ordered it.
That was interesting, because I heard Peter Gabo give a big laugh about that one time.
Oh, yeah.
Years ago.
No, that's where we learned it, the Sea of Galilee mud mask.
Yeah. Well,
and oddly enough, if you recall a story from just within the last few months, was it Rand Paul? It was Rand Paul who was involved when some fundamentalist Christians went skinny dipping in the Sea of Galilee, because they get all head up about the Sea of Galilee because that's where Jesus took a walk. That's the significance of the Sea of Galilee to these people.
Okay, all right, that's fine. But I thought he went in the Dead Sea. No?
Nope, Sea of Galilee.
Well, he could have gone into the Dead Sea. He may have found it pretty easy to float, particularly with...
I don't think he needs to take a big old drink of it.
No, he's so full of, and I won't say the words what I did two nights ago, but he's so full of that. I'm sure he's pretty heavy, so, I mean, he could have floated pretty easily on the surface of that water, that's for damn sure.
Well, he's floating now, Jim, because he is the darling preference of the Conservative Political Action Committee to be president in 2016.
Well, I guess you...
Like his daddy before him, he done won the straw poll.
Well, I'm not exactly certain as to how I would feel if I would win the straw poll among that crowd who gathered in, where was it, Maryland, last week or the last weekend, because I don't know if I would consider that too much of a compliment or not, you know?
Well, he's also been invited to go out and speak to the 2013 Lincoln Day dinner of the Iowa Republican Party.
Well, I think he's one of the so-called rising stars amongst a party that's trying to examine itself and realize why they lost so heavily to President Obama last November. And they still haven't gotten over that.
No, just like they didn't get over losing to Bill Clinton twice. But at the same time that they put out their post-mortem, as it's being referred to, Well, the Republican Party is anything but dead, Jim, because they're not.
Well, I know that. I mean, you know, it's kind of like Dracula. You know, no matter how many stakes you put through his heart, old Drac has a way of coming back in another movie, doesn't he?
Sadly, he does.
Well, I mean, you know, what would William Castle do if he wasn't able to figure out a way to bring old Christopher Lee back?
Well, I mean, one has to have one's priorities, right?
Well, you know.
The box office.
Yeah. At least these vampires that William Castle did, I mean, at least Dracula wasn't that bad looking. He said we had his fangs bared, and at least he could be polite in certain society, as opposed to some of these other gashing, bloodthirsty things. And I'll refer to Frank Langella, who was probably the best looking of all the vampires. Remember that one?
Yep, I do.
I mean, you know, if it were Robert Pattinson or Frank Langella back in 1979, hell, I'd have a Red Cross flag hanging in front of my house. Be a blood bank.
Really? Robert Pattinson?
Yeah.
Oh. That whole franchise just does nothing for me.
Well, that's okay. I mean, hell.
Mormon vampires, you know, go figure.
Well, I don't know about that, but I mean, you know, even Taylor Lautner playing part of the werewolf, he's not bad to look at either.
I have to say I have seen only snippets of those films because, well, there was
maybe
a...
Maybe Agnes would like to take a look at that.
Oh, no, she has. See, remember, on the day, it was, what, a couple of 3 months ago, we took our annual trip to the movie theater.
And you went to see Lincoln.
I went to see Lincoln while everybody else went to the vampire movie.
Right, right. Well, you know, hey, and isn't it Colin Farrell the one that she likes, or is it?
No. It was Brad Pitt in The Skirt and Troy.
Hmm.
Colin Farrell, she didn't mind, but no, it was no Brad. That whole running and jumping in the skirt thing and with the sword in hand, I can't watch the movie with her anymore.
Well, what was she looking for?
What do you mean? No, she's not. She ain't looking for something. She done found it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But I can't watch the movie with her anymore. It's like, I don't know. I'm looking at a woman. This is unbecoming.
Oh, my Lord in heaven. Oh, God in heaven.
Caesar's wife, Schmeezer's wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were mentioning something about Egypt or something about during the period. I believe those people who invaded Egypt were called the Hyksos. And they were the ones who brought in chariots and horses and stuff like that. As a matter of fact, they even buried their horses.
Well, there's the Hyksos invasion, but there's also a number of other, or not a number of, but there are other other individuals who are involved in the process. I mean, there's a lot of people moving around back then.
Well, the Hyksos were the main ones because it was Pharaoh Amasai the first who drove them out. And founded the, if I'm not mistaken, the 18th dynasty.
Yeah, Old Kingdom, New Kingdom, Middle Kingdom. I get lost in that.
So there were a number of upheavals and things like that, but the major incursions against the Egyptians were, I think the Babylonians were involved in certain conflicts, but the Hyksos really gave them a lot of trouble. But then again, taught them a lot about chariots and how to use horses and improved their style of warfare. And Egypt ascended back into her former glory after the problems with the Hyksos.
Yeah, most people don't realize that by the time of the warfare of the classical world with which we're familiar, the chariot had largely fallen into disuse. That's why you had chariot races. It was kind of a throwback. It's kind of like in the 21st century we watch horse racing.
Well, I mean, you know, Egyptian chariots, particularly the ones they found in King Tutankhamun's tomb, the one that was opened by Howard Carter, I mean, they were extremely well made.
And ornate in that case.
But, I mean, they were very well made, and they had a special type of bridle that would enable the chariot to move in at least four directions. Because the previous ones were just flat on the ground. And if you really want, it was kind of like
Yeah, they turned turtle real easy.
Exactly. And as a matter of fact, I don't know. It's even speculated that King Tutankhamun or the son of Amenhotep III, the one who's, like I said, whose tomb reveals so many treasures, he could have been even killed.
Yeah, that's out there. But the other thing that's fascinating out of all of that is you know, Tutankhamun, Amun being the operative syllables there, you know, he only lived to be 18.
Yeah.
And he was as revered as he was because he had returned the old state religion.
Well,
in the wake of the
Akhenaten's
shift and purge and
Amenhotep III, who became Akhenaten and who, as a matter of fact, went on down the Nile to build a huge city and was the devotee of the Aten, the sun god. It's just amazing their history.
Well, you know, that some speculate, and I'm probably getting a bunch of this wrong, but some speculate that the Aten cult was an early reaching for monotheism.
Well, exactly. And it was, because he completely debunked all the former Egyptian gods, which really pissed off the priests because they lost their whole livelihood under him. And he ruled for...
Well, they lost control of the state.
Yeah.
Because the priestly class largely administered, and state is the wrong word to use, of course, but they lost cultural control because he took it from them.
It was the state because the pharaoh was the state. And, of course, you know, the constructions of their tombs were state enterprises. I mean, the people who built the pyramids were not slaves.
No, they were not.
And, you know, it was quite a shakeup when Akhenaten and his wife was Nefertiti or no, Akhenaten. But anyway, not.
Well, and, but in that city that he built subsequent to their deaths, both of their names were defaced. You know, that's the tough thing about.
I mean, you know, Thutmose III, you know, had an aunt named Queen Hatshepsut, the woman who wore the false beard,
mm-hmm.
who was his regent, and who built the temple at Deir el-Bari. He did the same thing to her.
Well, that's the tough thing about writing in stone. You know,
I mean, you know, basically, if you wanted to...
When Yul Brynner says, let no longer the name of Moses be written in the land of Egypt, you know, that means, you know, that's job creating for a whole lot of stone defacers.
Well, that's true, because as Joshua also said in the movie, the stone the pharaohs, like their images, carved deeply. And so I guess it was a bit of a... It wasn't exactly like hitting a delete button now, was it?
No. And you couldn't exactly throw a freeze or a column into a fire. You had to burn the whole city down.
Yeah. Well, Egyptology has always fascinated me. As a matter of fact, if you could look at where I'm looking at now, you will see so many of the images of their gods here.
Yeah, well, like I said, it was one of my grandmother's books on archaeology that, like I said, the first big word I ever learned, two, three years old. And it was largely taken up with Egyptology.
But there are certain people who have been in here, like tradespeople and stuff like that, and I get the strangest looks because they look at all these statues of these anthropomorphic gods, and I think they may think that maybe I subscribe to that, and, you know, I've tried to explain to a couple of them who they are and what they were, and, of course, it's totally lost on them. And I said, look, don't worry about it. Right over there in the corner is a great big statue of the Virgin Mary and St. Michael. So, okay.
Yeah, you're kind of taking the Hindu approach. All of them are welcome.
Well, I've got Buddha. I've got, you know, a number of things. And I've always said, allow 100 schools of thought and 100 flowers bloom, to quote our dear old friend Chairman Mao. That's where that came from.
You need a good Huitzilo Pochtli in there, Jim, if you don't have one already.
Well, I do have a small thing that I'm not able to download photographs and stuff like that of some images that were taken from one of the cenotes that were given to my father, whom I inherited. So he's not forgotten either. But, you know, when it all comes to shove, I mean, you know, you got your opinions about religion. We talked about it before. And, you know, I think one night I basically described my own beliefs, and I'm not trying to be contentious, but I hope you don't think I am, is when I read to you the Apostles' Creed.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is doctrine. It is dogma.
Yeah, the difference being that it is not scriptural.
Well, whatever. But nonetheless...
Are we talking about the Nicene Creed?
We're talking about the the Nicene Creed, yeah.
Yeah.
There were two. And there's one that the Catholic Church uses. It's a little bit longer, but it basically describes the visions of apostolic succession and things of that nature. And, you know, I can like being saying this. I know your audience won't, but, well, it's just something I believe in.
That's fine.
And never have doubted. Never had a reason to doubt it.
That's fine. History is what it is, and belief is what it is. And it's kind of like what Dr. John wrote a little bit ago, that, you know, science is science, and religion and myth are religion and myth, and it is a very good thing to keep the two separate.
Well, yeah. And you know, archaeological science, in certain situations, they're really becoming more and more sophisticated than they were in the 20s, for example, when people like Howard Carter would go in and deface things and stuff like that. They have become...
Well, yeah, that image of Heinrich Schliemann running around with the death mask of Priam.
Are you sure that's Priam or Odysseus?
No, that's Priam.
I always thought that was the golden mask. Maybe that was somewhere else.
No, he was, yeah, and Helen's neckwear.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, and all that was toted off to the Berlin Museum, along with the bust of Nefertiti.
Yeah, and if I ever get there, I want to see it desperately.
Well, I have a beautiful, beautiful exact copy of that. And it's lit at night when the lights go on. And, you know, it's just my respect for an extremely advanced civilization who did marvelous things. I mean, to have been able to have constructed those pyramids and the stuff they did. I mean, it's just extreme. The ability
to organize that level of labor, to command that ability, that level of labor, to feed that much labor.
Well, that was done through the state. I mean, the state did that. Like I said, these people did it willingly, and, you know, I think they were well-fed. In particular, like I say, the pharaohs enjoyed having their images carved deeply, so they weren't starved or anything like that. They found whole cities and little mastabas in which they were built and stuff like that, which were like diminutive pyramids. And I guess if you were buried in the sand, hopefully that they would be able to enjoy some of the pharaoh's bounty that was buried with him. And unfortunately, there were too many tomb robbers who were in on it, who were probably priests.
Yeah, and some of those tombs were robbed within a couple of hundred years.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I've read the transcripts of the trials, the ones that were caught. And I'll guarantee you one thing, that's something you didn't want to be caught doing. Because they really dealt pretty severely with those people. I don't know if they cut off their hands and feet and stuff like that, but it was pretty nasty.
Well, even reading the stories of the recovery of so-called lost books is fascinating, just to see the intrigues that are involved with all of that. The story surrounding, you know, one of the most recent discoveries was the release of the so-called Gospel of Judas, which sheds light on the essential conflicts that arose in the early Christian church regarding whether they would worship the death or the life.
Yeah, and they've had trouble dating those and stuff like that, so we shall see. But I will mention, going back to the pharaoh thing with Akhenaten, you remember an author named Michel Voltari who wrote The Egyptian?
Yeah, I've read it. It's a wonderful book.
Uh-huh, and the film was pretty good, too.
I never saw the film.
Oh, yeah, it had, let's see, Evan Purdom, and, of course, the one who played Horemheb, who was going to take over, which he did, the general, the cheesemaker's son, was played by Victor Mature. never could quite get into him because my father said, my God, he always looks like he smells something nasty.
He does. He does.
I mean, he always had this look that, you know, I mean, I have no problems with Victor Mature. I mean, he played some good roles and stuff like that, but he always liked, you know, there was something up his nose or something like that. I don't know.
No, I think your dad was spot on.
Yeah, he always did say that. Did you watch He Sam any today?
No, I did not. I was actually over working on technology with Dr. Bill most of the afternoon.
Yeah, they had Brother Ryan there, your favorite person.
And, oh, the zombie-eyed Granny Starver?
Oh, yeah, and they had the vote on the resolution and stuff like that for the Ryan budget, and then they had, they tried to, the Democrats tried to, the Democrats from Maryland tried to propose a counter thing, which was soundly defeated. I think his name was Van something.
Chris Van Hollen.
Van Hollen. And it was, I hope that Ryan budget doesn't get passed because it's pretty draconian.
Well, sure it is, because it is a it's a wholesale liquidation of the commons.
Well, yeah, but you never know that to hear him talk about it.
No, he'll put it out there in some, you know, that, I mean, we know that Orwellian, that kind of Orwellian doublespeak, Jim. We have to kill Medicare in order to save it. That's essentially what he's saying.
And I think he was going on about $57 billion being taken from Medicare for Obamacare. But if they should, for example, overturn Obamacare, where do you think that $57 billion would go?
Well, first of all, that $57 billion is a dummied up number.
Well, that's just what they're saying. I'm not quoting it verbatim.
I mean, but do you remember? You remember the campaign when Barack Obama's robbing Medicare. He needs to keep his hands off our government insurance.
Well, basically, I think they're trying to pretend as though they care about Medicare and stuff like that, which I really don't think they do. I know they don't. And what they want to do is turn into a voucher system. We talked about this before, and what gives states block grants and stuff like that.
Yeah, which would be wholly insufficient to the task at hand. You cannot run Medicare or Medicaid as a voucher program or a block grant.
Well, let's hope that doesn't ever come to that, because God knows, because they would want that to happen. But the Senate did approve the funding of the government this afternoon, 78 to 20-something or something like that. So they did approve that. So that's going to go to the House, and I guess the House will probably fund the government through the end of the fiscal year.
You think?
Well, they're being hopeful. You know, I used to be able to establish, to a degree, certain, you know, realities. But who knows what they're going to do? I don't know. What is the balance of the House now?
435 total members. And I think the Democrats are 15 short.
15 short? I think they'll probably fund the government. I think they can do that.
I don't know. They've got an ideological purity test. If they do it, it'll be the latest piece of legislation that has passed the Congress, passed the House of Representatives, with a minority of Republicans, a minority of the majority voting in favor. And those people will be punished severely.
Well, what happens if they don't?
Well, the Republican Party would like to find out. I mean, for instance, some of the shenanigans that took place in the Senate today had to do with the fact that a Republican was trying to offer a standalone piece of legislation that would refund the air traffic control towers. Because suddenly they realized that their fat's in the fire with that.
Well, wasn't there another one that was introduced trying to reopen the White House for the national parks or something like that?
That's happened, and yeah.
Well, I just wondered what success they would have in doing something like that. I don't know. But that's just a minor, minor, minor thing, really, right there when it comes to, you know, to what they're trying to do. But anyway, I was just looking at C-SPAN and seeing what was going on. And honestly and truly, the way these people behave on camera in both houses really surprises me as to how they ever get anything done. The trouble is, I don't think they've been able to get a whole lot done, period.
No, no. Oh, and by the way, I did see your note there. It was Eratosthenes.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, it was 7 degrees between the cities that he made the difference. And I think he was born around 253 B.C., something like that. It's been a long time since I read his biography or whatever, but it's just incredible. I mean, this guy in the second century before Christ was able to establish that the world was in fact round and came to, I don't know, less than 300 miles and really estimated the diameter of the earth.
Yeah, and that knowledge, and it's pretty, it was a pretty close estimate.
It was within just a couple hundred miles, 25,000 plus or something like that. I believe that's the circumference of the earth. And it's just incredible. Here we go back to that period of time in Egypt and places like that. And God, I wish they had never burned the library at Alexandria. That was a terrible thing. When you think of how much knowledge was really lost.
Oh, the plays of Euripides, Wisdom of the Ages.
Well, the Hebrew Gospels, everything. I mean, it was all centered there. I mean, Alexandria was designed to be a center of culture. And
but, for instance, if you read the histories, it's so very tantalizing. Or even social commentary, because a historian will say, so-and-so said thus and such in his book, blah, blah. Well, that's the only reference we have to the existence of that book. So we know the book existed, it's just gone.
Exactly. And, you know, like in that, really, I can imagine what Cleopatra must have felt as played by Liz Taylor when she told Julius Caesar, you burned my library, you asshole.
But, you know, one of the things we found out is that reporting may have been overplayed. Part of it probably did burn, but not all of it. The real death knell of the library at Alexandria came at the hands of Christianity.
Well, I don't know about that, but, I mean, it could have been impacted also by the earthquake that destroyed that part of the city, because the library, to best of my knowledge, was fairly near the royal enclosure.
I think it was part of it.
Which is completely underwater now, like the Pharaoh's lighthouse. Who knows? I mean, you know, it's like I say, and when we're talking about Numidra and Babidra, that whole area is sort of subject to a lot of earthquakes and stuff like that, and the sea and the coast of the Mediterranean has changed an awful lot.
But you know, there was the Library of Alexandria, and it was the focal point, but by the time of Imperial Rome, there were a number of libraries in that city. And they also went away.
Well, yeah, I'm afraid that the Goths, the Visigoths, and people like that were very kind when they finally breached the walls of Rome, particularly when they thought in the last episode when they had been tricked or fooled or something like that. What was his name? The last Visigoth, Odovaker?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was pretty nasty. Did a lot of bad stuff. Well, look, I've taken enough of your time going on with this. So we shall see. And that's my story, and I'm just going to stick to it. And you have a good evening, my friend.
All right, you take care, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Our good buddy Jim. And we find ourselves two-thirds of the way through the program this evening. Jim's right. There was a fire during the Alexandrian War under Julius Caesar. But the library still existed after that. 270-275, Aurelian attacked Alexandria. And then finally, what was left of the Library of Alexandria and what wisdom it yet contained was paid to by the followers of Jesus Christ upon the decree of the Coptic Pope Theophilus, and that would be toward the close of the 4th century. Turbulent times. It is Prayer Meeting Wednesday on the Horn, and your thoughts, your comments are more than welcome. Number is 304-658-3333. Email comes in to Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. And you can reach the program via Skype at Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H. O-R-N. Well, it's producing on the fly. It gets to be a pain in the ass sometimes. So let's take a break, and then you chime in with your thoughts. This is Conversation Radio. Listener supported. And we are only $120 away from meeting Robert's March 20th challenge from down under. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So too is the snail mail address. So light up the phones. Ain't no sense in having a congregation if ain't nobody talking. This is one of the few congregations where you can do that instead of sitting in terrified silence. This is the Horn.
A one, two, three.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins next. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Bob.
7.5 minutes past the hour. 7:08 here in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone. Don't know what's going on out the road from here, but apparently every emergency response vehicle in the last couple of hours has gone out the road. That was a little disturbing. Roaring fire trucks, ambulances. You see that? All you can do is hope everybody's okay. I mentioned that because I figured somewhere along the way some of the sirens might have gone out over the air. Going back to the phones in just a moment, 304-658-3333 is the number. On Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. Note coming in from Cassie. She says, so I graduated from high school almost 3 years ago, and even though I was a debate nerd with a final GPA far above 4.0 at a school that didn't win a single championship of any kind, I was a high school student in Texas. And I know a fair amount about the culture that worships Friday nights at the local stadium. Beginning in elementary school, boys are revered more than girls. Strong and large and athletic boys more than anyone else, and eventually football players are archangels. There are weekly pep rallies in their honor beginning in sixth grade, and they can take class time when nothing else is ever allowed to interrupt. By high school, the boys have joined the apostles on Mount Olympus and can do no wrong. They cannot fail. They cannot lose status except by acting gay or losing on the field. And girls can't say no to them. They own the girls. They own the school. They own it all. They are, in short, says Cassie, what Repiglicans aspire to be. And so, something like Steubenville, she says, was bound to happen. And I would add, not just bound to happen, but happened, happens, is happening, will have happened, and every verb tense that you can apply to this sorry and shoddy situation. Cassie says it's just a surprise it doesn't happen every year in every state. I wouldn't sit around waiting to be surprised, Cassie, because it probably does. I've got a story right here. From Ohio to Connecticut. Allegations of rape against two more athletes, high school athletes, Edgar Gonzalez and Juan Toribio. They're charged with second-degree sexual assault of a 13-year-old girl. Apparently, there's an overall hazing culture at Torrington High School in Connecticut. But school officials are running out to do damage control, alleging that, well, this isn't part of a cultural problem. I'm sorry. At Torrington High School, you do not get to declare that there is no such thing as a rape culture that permeates the entirety of the United States of America. In the wake of the allegations, however, remember what Cassie said a minute ago about the athletes own the girls? Judge it by this yardstick. In the past few weeks since these allegations came to light,
a smear campaign has been run against the 13-year-old. Athletic director of Torrington High School, Mike McKenna, said, "If you look at crime statistics, these things happen everywhere, and we're not any different than any other community." But, yeah, over on the Twitter, she has been called a whore, this 13-year-old victim. This 13-year-old has been called a whore, castigated for being a snitch, accused of ruining the lives of Toribio and Gonzalez. One Twitter user called A Smedic, A-S-M-E-D-I-C-K, said, "I want to know why there's no punishment for young hoes." Then Shelby Kalinsky tweeted, "Sticking up for a girl who wanted the D and then snitched? Have a seat, please." A.U. William, A-Y-O-O, William, tweeted, "You destroyed two people's life." Someone else responded, "I hope you got what you wanted." How about that? A 13-year-old gets raped. And the question is about what she wanted in getting raped. But we don't have a rape culture in the United States. Right? Under the subject line, Jesus, Darlene writes, "Yep, Torrington is the city right next door to me and my town. This is disgusting." Tim from L.A. writing with a note for Cassie. Subject line, "An array of hope for Cassie." He says, "With every brainless jock in Texas or any of the 50 states wanting to strut their machismo, there in the corner of the room, a member of Anonymous, tearing down the facade, ask the morons at Steubenville." Darlene also adds, "The athletic director at Torrington High should be fired. I'm sick of this male bravado crap that we keep seeing." And, of course, that is a deeper inquiry. Whence comes that machismo, that bravado? And why does it persist? And why is it the defining element of maleness? Why isn't intelligence the defining element of maleness? And is this a problem that occurs? No, it happens in other countries. But there are other countries where more value is placed on intelligence in males, on the ability to get a job done, on creativity, and less on brutishness. You know, with what Cassie just wrote, it reminds me, Cassie, you need, well, you know, because I'm sure you've got so much time, so much indolent, you're just wandering around Princeton in indolent boredom. But what you just wrote there, You need to blog a little more when you get a chance on a personal level, on an observational level, on a commentary level. Because the ability to speak truth is never in large enough supply. Maybe someday we will have an answer somewhere on this planet that addresses the brutality that attends the male experience. Wouldn't it be wonderful to live in a society where a person was free to be what he or she simply is? Anatomy is anatomy. Gender is not anatomy, and anatomy is not gender. Of course, the right wing likes to use the term sex. That's that goober in Arizona. Whenever I see someone referring to sex, as in, they don't even want to be the real sex that they are. Doesn't that tell us just a little bit? Doesn't that tell us how these narrowly defined, intolerant, bigoted, homophobic, everybody but them phobic, theophobic people think? Their sex, their right sex. It means that they are defining the entire rich panorama of any given human experience solely by biological reproductive process. No wonder in the more progressive neighborhoods of the youth movement, to the extent there's a youth movement, that gender roles are being ditched to the point that pronouns are being, you know, pronouns, him, her, he, she, his, hers. They're being ditched. And an inquiry is underway as to how we create a less gender-based realm of communication. I mean, I joke about Agnes watching Brad Pitt in Troy. I mean, it's not a joke. Ooh, look at them legs. You know, look at the arbitrary, the capricious, and hypocritical standards apply. Would that goober in Arizona dare walk up to some big burly Scotsman and tell him what a pansy he is for wearing his kilt? I wouldn't advise it. Does that God-fearing Arizona legislator somehow think less of his personal Lord and Savior because Jesus never wore a pair of trousers in his life? Yeah. And of course, there are assumptions made inside the gender construct, like I said, that people are nothing but their reproductive organs. There are oodles of cross-dressing men who are as straight as a arrow. But that's too complicated for a fundy or a pig licking or a right winger or a tea bagger or most libertarians. Most of that crowd falls back on that passage from the Book of Myths, And a man shall not put on the raiment of a woe man, and a woe man shall not put on the raiment of a man. And that was written into law at a time when everyone was wearing dresses. I don't know. Maybe the women got to, accessorize a little bit more? Look at the use of sumptuary laws in cultures around the world. They were done in France. They were done in England. Hell, they were done in Mesoamerica. Laws designed not so much around gender, but to keep people from expressing themselves outside the social norms established by the powers that be. And yet some people are still worried about whether or not... Jesus. Randy, by email, noting, my centrist father is fond of the gender-spoofing phrase, write 'em, cow person, when comparing to the gender-correct Madam Chairwoman. Language is a manifestation of the deeper levels of human existence. We were human before we spoke, I think. We were certainly human before we wrote. Was there a male fig leaf and a female fig leaf back when Eve screwed the pooch and got him kicked out of the garden? No. Fig leaf's a fig leaf. Texas Betsy noting, in a fifth grade bilingual class, the gender roles are firmly in place and rigidly enforced, even though the crazy liberal teacher forbids it. Don't touch that Barbie. It'll make y'all girly. Go play with your truck, boy. And yet at the same time, have you ever noticed the number of video games that are based on the premise behind paper dolls? Paper dolls, of course, you know, little paper doll, and you've got all the clothing that you've attached with the little paper tabs. Well, what is a game where you level up by buying armor or a different gun than a way of taking the paper dolls model and finally figuring out a way to monetize and commercialize and consumerize the paper doll concept? Good God, there was a game out a few years ago called DOA Extreme Beach Volleyball that men all over, because they had on break from their assassinating martial arts girls, rendered quite voluptuously. And guys were playing, I've got enough points now that I can buy her the new bikini. Really? Oh, no, I'm strictly hetero. Oh, that bikini's just darling. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Mark.
Hey, Mark.
Bob, I took my granddaughter to a public park, the Common common goods tonight, and she's five, and a little guy. I think the people that were watching him, the grandparents, possibly were said he was like 4 and a half, similar in height. He just wasn't as well developed. She's got some strength about her, and she happened to be going on this. It's a great playground here at this one particular location, and it's one thing where you climb up it and climb up a series of these wheels. You get to the top, and then the bar loops over to a pole in the middle, which is probably about an 8-inch pole, which I never even recommended to her to slide down. And for some reason, this other little guy brought out some competition or character in her, but she'd done a lot on that playground prior to him being there, and he was getting upset earlier in the evening, not being able to climb up the slide backwards. There was a part of me out of compassion. I said, in my mind, I said to his grandparents, maybe he's just got, sneakers that aren't quite as gummy as Hannah's. But she had done it before. But when I got over there, I watched, she climbed to the top of these series of wheels, and then, I had been trying to push her earlier, to grab the bar, and then slide your hands over to get to that main pole in the middle of the series of three or stacks of wheels. There's three stacks of wheels there, which you occupy one at a time as you go up and over. And she slid over on the handrail to get to the main pole, and then slid down it without much hesitation. I don't know where the sudden burst of confidence came from. But, in respect to the observation you're making when it comes to genders, I didn't over adulate her, nor did I under adulate her, and I didn't make the boy that was there. He was not my responsibility, and just because it's your grandchild doesn't mean they're going to pay you direct attention or what we say or think is maybe even important to people that we love. But I do keep those things in mind when it comes to people's masculinity. And then the grandfather came over. And a very nice guy, very very civilized, and he said that they were somewhere at Disney at a theme park there that's very very physical thing, and the person that really rules the roost there, and I get the impression that she worked there, was a female, and she could pretty much beat any guy that comes in there on these different events. And I was lucky to have grown up in a family, on a personal note, to where girls got as much attention as the boys did, and turned out to be just as athletic and in possession of just as many trophies when it came to the sport of BMX bicycling. So listening to your show and talking to people and living my life and looking where we are at, politically, I think that was more of a gift than a hindrance. And it's a not a rarity, but a little bit. I thought a lot of people were trending in that direction, but I guess it's just throw all that down and grab your machine guns. But
I've got this mental image, Mark, of some right-wing parent yelling at some little boy, put down the Barbie and step away from the Easy Bake Oven.
Well, I'm sure. And, I can see people struggling with that when you look at a little guy that's not as macho as he, he may or not ever be or whatever. But people putting pressure in, and you see the father or the male role models standing there struggling with where they're going to go with their approach to that. I think there is more freedom today concerning that subject, and I think it's moving rather quickly. Excuse me, sorry about that. And I'm glad for that. And I agree with your earlier statement about wouldn't it be nice to live in a country or a world starting with our own nation, and where you can be the person that you are, is the way you put that. And I thought that was pretty profound. And it takes courage to be who you are. And I respect the courage of people that are transgendered or are strong lesbian or strong, but not even strong homosexuals or
I'm a strong human being.
They are strong, and love is love, and hate is hate, and I'm also in favor of people, on a personal note, being able to marry whoever they love, considering how many, well, not to defend that position, but consider how many children there are, that remain in homes, without parents. And, so any family of any nature that's able to raise a family, raise a child safely and securely, I would be in favor of. But that's coming from a big old tough, tattoo-laden macho marine with a high-pitched voice. But, I wanted to make the comment about the current Pope, not because I was a baptized Catholic, but I guess I do kind of keep an eye on that when you go to the Marines, they put you in. The only thing about discussion when it comes to religion is when you walk up there to get your dog tags and go, what religion? They look at you and you go, oh, shit, I guess Catholic, yeah. And that's about the last year we talk about it. So that's about all I know about that, and I dropped out of catechism, but I was only five when I was going. It was just way over my head. I actually would have liked to have learned some of that so I would decide what I thought was important or was not. But from a layman standpoint, I see this Pope Francis Bergoglio from Argentina. I think he got out of Argentina now, looking at the political climate there just in time. They have just put 11 or 12 people here real recently. And, of course, they've been going after people for the last 20 years from the late 70s with total American support, especially under the Nixon administration and then going on into Reagan. But how they had put how the right-wing government in Argentina had murdered a lot of students and union sympathetic people, male and female, with American help, because the American-owned corporations and the American-Argentinian-owned corporations were breaking their labor unions, which is what they're doing here slowly and rather successfully. But the Argentinian people, were very smart. They knew what was happening to themselves, which is why they, and Ecuador and Bolivia and I believe Brazil and Venezuela have now currently opted out of the IMF, which to me as a layman is the imposition of the IMF into Latin America is like what the American banks and the American British banks have done to the Europeans, the euro, and then forced the euro upon the Europeans. Nobody in Europe had requested that, but we sure made sure that they got it, and then we gave them all of our bad paper when it came to our housing market. And then that tears down their economy, and then we blame it on their socialism. But that's because they bought bad money. But that's just coming from a carpenter standpoint. But getting back to the priest, that's now the Pope. He has actually been requested to speak concerning, he had hid some people on an island that the Catholic Church owns, which is in Rio Plata, the huge river there, where island there called El Silencio. And he had hid some priests that were pro people, like Archbishop Romero, for the listeners, and also in the same time frame, in the late 70s, early 80s, it's account for poor people in El Salvador. And for anybody listening that does not know this, Archbishop Romero was shot in a Catholic church in a kill position in his throat, I believe, by a sniper that was trained in the United States at the Church of America. So so getting back to the current Pope, what he apparently did when an American Human Rights Commission came to Argentina looking for clues, this Pope with the end of the Videla government in Argentina worked in concert to hide these two priests that had been previously held, tortured, interrogated, and probably got out with their lies so they would not be able to speak to the Human Rights Commission. So it's kind of like we'll promote you high enough to where you don't have to speak any truth if you're big enough. Kind of you're beyond foreclosure. You're beyond. Your alums failed you. You're untouchable if we can just promote you high enough. So we really don't see this guy. He walks around smiling and stuff, and he looks kind of innocent. But I think that's kind of a scary dude right there. And I also draw the connection. People say, well, Mark, you're political. I don't consider myself political. I just consider a lot of people not really aware. I think politics is body bags to a Marine or to a soldier or to somebody in a form. Politics is who will kill you and who won't. And I learned an actual real-life lesson by voting and proudly voting for President Jimmy Carter and then seeing quite the difference when the Reagan administration came in to power. And totally, I actually, when you're on the United States State Department, you can see the leaders that transition out, the ambassadors, and you literally can talk to them and see how they treat you as a human being, and they really reflect that administration. I noticed when Reagan's people showed up in Argentina when I was there in the 70s, early 80s, it was very rough, and they were wide-open cowboys, where I had, under the Carter administration, there was just so much more compassionate and educated and caring people. My ambassador was Mari Lucy Jaramillo, who had been a University of New Mexico professor of linguistics, a political appointee. He was a very kind, caring, educated woman, Mexican-American woman, who had so much composure, so much class, and so much natural leadership. An ambassador is the equivalent rank-wise in the American military as a brigadier general. Now, in an emergency situation, regardless of stars on your collar, Oklahoma Marine Corps, PFC, well, you won't be a PFC, but you'd be an NCO guarding the U.S. Embassy, your last orders would come from the ambassador, regardless of whether they are a civilian or a military, and they usually are. Nine times out of ten, they're going to be civilian. And I also met Fernando Rondon, who was another superhuman. He was a deputy chief, went on to work in Latin America. And then as I go down to Argentina, I ran into the Reagan people, and they were not quite so kind. But I did play tennis with people that were in the CIA, guys that had been, some had civilian backgrounds and some had military, that were CIA agents. I actually got on an elevator one morning in doing my job in uniform with our khaki shirt with our dress and trousers, and you're armed and you're a public person in a locked up bomb-proof building, but you also do internal patrols. And one of the people on the elevator that morning was a friend of mine as a CIA agent, and I said, Greg, how are you doing? And he said, good. And I go, what do you got there? And he's got on a really well-tailored suit and real squared away, but his hair's a little longer, and it's over his ears, but it's still squared away. And turns out, he's a U.S. Army captain / CIA person. And he said, well, I've got something for the president. And I looked at him, and I said, you're serious, aren't you? And he goes, yeah, this is going to the president, President Carter. And so, you don't ask any more questions than that. And I wasn't being a clown, but you're up close and personal with these people, and they can tell by the way you carry yourself whether you're worth communicating with. And there were Marines that I worked with that didn't care or were just kind of not the sharpest guys. And there were other guys that knew, and we would talk amongst ourselves about different things. And some of my buddies went on to go into the FBI, or one friend, he's a retired lieutenant colonel, a JAG officer with the Marine Corps. He's retired. You see people take different career paths, and they're usually pretty squared away guys. The final comment I'd like to make would be about Bain Capital and its inception. As best as I can tell, I've not done a lot of reading on it, but Bain Capital, what's his name, Romney, gets inheritance money, and he's looking to create this corporation, which, what a coincidence, Benjamin Netanyahu ends up working with Bain Capital in Boston, and, he had a hard time even speaking English today. He wanted war with Iran to have already broken out with the president standing there. He's putting words in President Obama's mouth, and you might want to stick to whatever language you speak in that country of yours, whatever you call that, but he's not very good with the English. But any case, I'm a big fan of Simone Perez, though, because he's more peace-oriented, democratic-type leader. Benjamin Netanyahu is a dictator. But
I had occasion today, Mark, because I was on the road and I turned on the radio, and lo and behold, the little flickering candle flame radio station across the river that I worked for a couple of years has ditched its local right-wing the propagandist in favor of a show piped in from Fox, literally Radio Rwanda. And I forget what her name is, something Tomaine or whatever. And she was going, I mean, going on and going on and going on and going on today about, you know, why doesn't Barack Obama love the Israelis? Why won't he speak at the Knesset? Oh, it was sickening, Mark. Just sickening. Yeah. And you know why? Yeah. You know why he won't speak at the Knesset. I hope I know why he won't speak at the Knesset. Because he's not going to legitimize an apartheid regime.
Well, just a mere presence would certify red lights and green lights to people. So, you know, of course, he's got...
yeah, he is not going... He's not going to be... Well, no, I'm not going to say that. That'll be interesting.
Well, tricked or intimidated or... I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but, you know,
He's not going to be turned into a propaganda unit.
No. Yeah, he's a sharp cookie, and I've watched the president so much, I could just see the relaxed smile that he normally has, and the one that's it looks to be a relaxed smile, but it's he's doing the best he can to put up with. I had the television muted here, but I was watching. I believe it was Netanyahu's wife, maybe. And she just looked like a smartass to me, but the way she just her body language, I was like, but you know, I think I had to go there. Just on a side note, it is so astounding to me if you take the American gun issue and these poor children getting machine gunned to death, Aaron, and with no legislation other than maybe they might get some progress on the clips. But Rachel Maddow brought out a good point, Bob. She said that, you know, had they had the 10-round clips that jackass in Connecticut that shot those children, would have required him to carry 14 10-round clips. But in the fact that he had 30-round clips, it only required him to carry 3 or 4, and he got that many rounds off. He got 90 to 100-some rounds off within 5 minutes, which is that's forever firing that many rounds. But just the clips, and that's how the shooting in Arizona gets broken up, I guess. When that kook out there reloaded his, he had a 20 or 30 round clip in a pistol. So it makes it almost like a machine pistol. Literally, a woman, shoves a kid, and then the retired Army guy, an officer, a 65-year-old dude, you know, still has upper body strength and knowledge and integrity, and he's a Democrat, so I know he knows how to fight. Puts the squeeze on the jackass, and that's how they prevented more people from getting shot that day. I think that's. You know, the details on these things are really obscured from us, unless you're right there. It's just like we had this kid here, and I call him a kid. He's 30 years old, Bob, here at University of Central Florida.
Oh, I read about that, Mark.
Bob, that thing was way more intense and more planned and more predilective, or I mean, more cunning and more planned out than when you originally watched the news story here locally. And then they can't help it either, but you're like, oh yeah, that's happening everywhere now. And then you go, oh wow, that was a huge near miss, Bob. That was a huge near miss.
Yeah, he shot himself, but when police went into his room, what, he had a bunch of bombs built?
Apparently, I haven't followed it. Though I'm only a little over an hour away, but I haven't followed it to that detail. Yes, there were bombs there, but also one thing I just arbitrarily caught. They interviewed a roommate or neighbor, I think it's a roommate actually, whether he must not be there all the time or whatever the issue was. And he had come home that evening around, if I got my facts straight, he gets home 10:30, whatever this whole event takes place, like a little around midnight, and he had planned to do this attack like at 2. He had his own mental set of marching orders that he had all written down. But apparently this guy just coincidentally is a veteran, an Air Force veteran, pretty well-spoken, calm, and he sees this guy, recognizes him as his roommate, and sees something about his demeanor, and he catches him in the door with his rifle, and he said, I just shoved the door closed real quick, and then I pushed something in front of something, so he ditched himself somewhere else, and I don't know if he got lucky or instinctually, but he was, when you listen to his interview, he was expecting to probably be shot, so he was smart enough to find something and then put something else between the two of them, and I'm wondering if that pissed the kook off enough to where he whacked himself because he realized his plan was spoiled, or maybe he locked him in his room somehow. I don't know that aspect of the detail, but it can show you that just with hit or miss or luck of the draw that you get people that know how to do the right thing at the right time through experience or luck or knowledge or training or any of that, but may have made the difference between hit or miss. But I would just like to hang up so I can hear other people talk to you, Bob. But the comparison or the connection, I should say, not comparison, but the connection between Bain Capital and then so here's Romney wanting to create this corporation, and so the Republicans send him down to South Florida, and he meets with apparently seven what they call literally in Latin America plantation owners from primarily El Salvador, but mostly Nicaragua, or excuse me, mostly Central America, in Miami in 1982. And they give him either $7 or $9 million amongst themselves, and then he marries that up with whatever money he'd gotten from his father who'd ripped off all the Chrysler workers. Because, you know, CEOs work so hard, they're entitled to all the hard work. You know, martinis and plaid pants will really wear a person down. But so he creates his Bain Capital, and he was actually warned by people and said, you do realize these are the folks that are sponsoring the death squads in Central America. And if people find out, you could end up having the blood that's on their hands connected to you. He was warned, and he actually gave it some thought, but he went ahead and did it. And that takes us right up to Iran-Contra, and that also takes us both to Ronald Reagan. And I say to all the goddamn Benghazi jackasses, I know.
And they are that.
You know, I literally, Bob, right before the election, I was down in Miami, and I was riding through Cutler Ridge, and my truck was a Sunday, and a big four-wheel drive pickup truck, real brand new, you know, big crew cab. And I looked, it was, you know, a blonde-haired American lady leaning out the passenger side. She's kind of cute. And there's a guy driving. I thought, well, whatever. And then, you know, I just looked over, and they started barking that out, Benghazi, and she's holding out a Romney sign. So I started, and traffic started backing up at this one particular red light. So every time they hollered Benghazi, I hollered back, the Klan, the KKK, KKK, and I have a very strong voice. It may not sound like it, but when I bark my voice, it's very strong, and I kind of drowned them out. And I looked at all the people around me in traffic, all that I could see, and they were laughing at them with what I was saying to them. But the Benghazi thing, I didn't realize. I mean, I did realize in 1983 the U.S. Embassy was attacked, the embassy, and there were 17 Americans killed. There were six of my fellow Marines. I think I might have known one for sure. I was in my time frame as a Marine security guard, and there were seven CIA people killed and three State Department people killed, and then they shared off basically the front of the embassy. So then what happens in October 23rd at 6 o'clock in the morning, a former U.S. Embassy vehicle had been, which had been stolen from the embassy at some point, had been turned into the largest bomb non-nuclear in world history, according to the FBI, combined with plastic and gas. And it drives its way into the Beirut University. I know that you know this story, Bob, but drives it into the and it's an open garden or an open bay building. There's some kind of garden stuff in the middle. It's a four-story building. It lifts a four-story building up, five-story building up, and throws into a 40-foot hole, if I have my facts straight, 40-foot deep, and kills a high school friend of mine that I've known since junior high, William Scott Summerhoff, a lieutenant. When he died, he got promoted to captain. And he's buried, ironically, just outside of my hometown in central Illinois. I say ironically, that's where, let's just say it's Grant, showed up at Fort Butler or whatever. Yeah, I think it's called Fort Butler. And he showed up in his Mexican American War tunic with no rank and a pair of blue jeans and all these dog and pony show soldiers are all gussied up to go fight this big war. Would see Grant standing there, and they looked, and they could tell that he was kind of real, and they knew that they weren't. So they'd say, who are you? And he'd quietly tell them, and they go, well, you don't need to be standing here. You need to go to the front of the formation. And the guys at the rear of the next formation would ask him, what's with your outfit? Who are you? And then they go, well, you need, and if you read Grant's memoirs, I guess he basically says, I just couldn't go back. They literally pushed me to the front of it. But the whole time, the Illinois governor didn't want to hear shit from Grant. And he was a mean customer on the battlefield. But anyway, I just find it ironic that Bain Capital and the Pope are kind of cruising the same similar circles, and it's almost like someone's covered the Pope up by sliding him in that position. And it's kind of a scary level of awareness there. I don't lose any sleep over it, but if you're our age, Bob, you see all the shit that's happened from Watergate to the Kennedy assassination. It's just really hard to look away. And they killed 30,000 Americans, and I remember as a young Marine watching in Buenos Aires, I'd go down to the plaza of the pink house, La Casa Rosada, and which is their White House with pink stone. It's a pink stone building. And watching the women out there, the mothers, Madres de la Plaza, marching. And then when you look and you see and ask and you hear and you go, wow. And then you have to, as they used to say in the United States, which side are you on? And I made it my political determination at that time who I made my convictions with, and they will never ever change. And to hear a person with so much heart and so much awareness and so well educated and so knowledgeable about religion, to politics, to environment, to economics, to American history, to the past, the present, and the future, and to being a loving father like yourself is very refreshing. And I consider you a gift, and I appreciate you being there for all of us, because you don't just coordinate this. You have your own person, and you're a real player. And as an American, I said it last night, I thought everybody was like a Bob Kincaid. I really did. I thought as a kid I was going to really have to work hard and hustle and learn and continue to care and grow to be like the people that I hear that you like and respect. But I don't find too many of them. I don't look for them real hard because I just don't see them anymore.
Well, it's kind of like what Kate said earlier in the program, Mark. She said, let me see if I can find the exact remark. Talking about what Dr. Bill's been describing. She said, I have been blessed with some extraordinary mentors and teachers who evidently didn't understand nor subscribe to Jefferson's idea of education. I was trained to be contentious, questioning, disruptive, and argumentative. All of this because most of my teachers demanded that I reach well beyond what I perceived to be my potential. I'm beginning to understand why most of those who are educated in the past four decades don't think the way I do. And then closed saying, I need to take notes in order that I can share with Dr. Bill some of my ideas. And I think she gets to the heart of it. There are those people, Mark, who are raised up to do as they're told. And there are others who, for one reason or another, are raised to ask questions. I fall into the latter category. Although I'll have to go put the C-clamp on my head after all those wonderful words you just said. Agnes will insist. I'm unbearable when I get the big head. But the fact of the matter is, there are just different approaches to what it means to be human and different approaches.